Welcome to Food Talk. I'm Kristen.
And I'm Teresa, and we're talking with the people who are growing, raising, harvesting, and producing food here in our bountiful coastal region.
And also to those who are selling, cooking, serving, and eating the freshest food available in our communities.
Join us today in a conversation about what's in season right now here on the North Coast.
Today we are talking with Julie Tennis, also known as the Bee Mentor, from Nassau, Washington. Welcome, Julie.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself? I mean, how did you end up on the North Coast, and what did you do before you were the Bee Mentor?
Well, I came to this area back in 2001, and I came as a park ranger. I transferred down here from Scenic Beach State Park, which is in Seebeck, Washington, near Bremerton, Washington, on the Hood Canal.
Oh, so ways.
Yeah, and from the Kitsap County area. And due to some personnel changes, I needed to relocate, and the interview that I had down here went well enough that they decided to hire me. And I worked at Cape Disappointment State Park until last June. It's been about a year now, and I worked a variety of different jobs with them. I started out as a campground ranger, so I was patrolling the campground, and I did some interpretive talks for folks, because interpretation is why I got into parks, interpretation of the natural resource, and so telling people about what they were seeing at the park. And then from there, I worked with the volunteers as a volunteer coordinator for a while. Wow. And then from there, I was the beach ranger, so I was in charge of patrolling Long Beach Peninsula. I had the whole 30 miles all to myself, pretty much.
Wow.
Yeah. It was pretty amazing. And then I realized I had an injury, I had a back injury, and the gear that I wore as part of my job was having a negative effect on my back, as well as sitting in a truck all day.
Oh,
and
sure.
So I decided to stop being a park ranger. And at that time, fortunately, a position came open at the park for an interpretive specialist, and they wanted somebody to do environmental education with the local schools. And so I transferred over to that position and did that for 3 years. And I got to teach kids from all different grade levels. And my favorite part was creating programs for them that encompassed the whole school year. So I got to take the kids outside every month as part of their classroom experience.
Great.
So they got to actually be outside and learn, which I think is really important. And we spend enough time inside as it is.
Yes,
we don't
yes.
need to do all of our nature learning inside as well. But due to budget cuts, that position was cut, and I was ready to move on and start a business of my own anyway. I have been a beekeeper for about a year, no, 3 years at that point. I started in 2008, and I wanted to delve more deeply into that. I really love to educate people about the natural world, and I have a love for bees. That might be a little strange. Every time I see them, I just think they're the most adorable creature on the planet. I think I have a reaction to bees like some people have a reaction to kittens and puppies. And so I wanted
they're
to share
kind of furry.
Them. Yeah, they are furry.
Furry.
If you
they
look
have
at them close.
Kind of cute little faces.
They do, especially bumblebees, you know, with that that long fur.
They are
and those,
very cute bumblebees. Yeah,
they're the teddy bears of the bee world, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So I started a website, and I'm still working on it. It's interesting. There's a big difference between being self-employed and working for someone else, and I'm still developing those skills.
Those
as
are
I go
challenging
on.
Skills, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm enjoying it, and I'm learning a lot, and I'm having a really great time in the process.
Well, I was lucky enough to attend a recent event that you put on. Actually, I've been to two events, and one was the Bee Social. And part of it was so fascinating because you talked about sort of why should we care about bees? I mean, you know, and here we're on a food show. Why, as eaters and producers?
Yeah, why do we care?
Why do we care?
That's a really good question. I don't think many people realize that the majority of the food that we eat as humans comes from plants that wouldn't exist if they were not pollinated by an animal. And there's a lot of different types of animals that pollinate plants. Bees, beetles, birds, bats are some, and butterflies, you know, all the bee words.
Bee.
Barracuda. No, seriously, though. There's a lot of different animals that pollinate plants, but the best of all of those are bees. And the reason that bees are the best pollinators is that they're purposefully gathering pollen. in order to feed it to their young. All the other animals are after the nectar, and the pollen rubs off on their fur or feathers and is transferred from plant to plant. But the bees are actually gathering that pollen and sticking it to themselves in different places, depending on the species of bee. And then when they go from one plant to another, there's a lot more pollen to be spread from plant to plant.
So they're not accidental pollinators at all. They're just, that's mm-hmm. really what they're after.
They're very intentional.
Right. Yeah. The pollen is the protein mm-hmm. that bees eat, and they get their carbohydrates from the nectar of the plant.
Well, one thing that I found so interesting is, I guess I didn't realize about all the different species of bees. Mm-hmm. And so one thing I learned was that maybe the honeybee isn't necessarily the best pollinator.
That's correct. In fact, honeybees aren't even native to North America. They came over with settlers in the 1600s. And have slowly been making their way across the continent, both as cultivated animals, you know, mm-hmm. by beekeepers, and also on their own as feral colonies. Mm-hmm. And they do pollinate plants, and in commercial productions, they might be the only pollinator that, like almond groves.
Yeah,
they might be the only pollinator simply because in a monocrop situation, where you have fields and fields of a single kind of plant, there's not enough diversity to support native pollinators because everything blooms at once and then there's nothing in bloom the rest of the year.
Oh, interesting.
And so they have to bring in honeybees to pollinate those plants because nothing else can survive there.
And then they take them away again.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like there's something that's trying to live there year-round.
Correct.
In
yeah.
those places. Yeah, it's a really challenging environment.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that if you want to help bees, one of the things is to put in borders of wildflowers. Let the edges of your farm go wild so that there's habitat for the native bees. And some farmers yeah. are actually finding that by doing that, they're mm-hmm. increasing their production because by allowing a place for those native bees to survive year-round, they're getting the side benefit of those native bees coming in and pollinating their crops. And the reason that native bees in general are better pollinators is because honeybees are hoarders.
Mm-hmm.
They're very efficient at gathering a large amount of food and the nectar and pollen and storing it in their home, in their honeycomb. The way that they gather pollen, they pack it into tight balls and just stick it onto their back legs in the area that has special hairs called scopae. And as a result, they aren't necessarily that good at transferring pollen from one plant to another because they've packed it all into this tight little ball.
Yeah.
Other bees, like the bumblebees, mason bees, leaf cutters, they're very furry, just like the honeybee, but they store, like a leaf cutter, for example, stores its pollen on its abdomen. If you were to look at a leaf cutter bee, the underside of its abdomen is like a hairbrush and very fuzzy, very, very fuzzy. And when it's full of pollen, it's just like a solid coat of yellow or orange depending on the plant. And so when it goes from one plant to another, its entire belly is rubbing on the plant and transferring that pollen, as opposed to a honeybee that its little elbows.
So
on
its elbows
legs.
Have to brush mm-hmm. in order for the pollen to transfer, and
right.
they don't always brush.
Correct.
That's so cool.
So what kind of native plants are really great for attracting our native bees?
Anything that produces a lot of nectar. In our area, the native bees that yeah. I'm familiar with on the coast are cosmopolitan. They'll go to anything that's producing nectar yeah. and pollen.
So their name yeah. is cosmopolitan?
No, they're just they're cosmopolitan by nature.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it, the key is to have things that bloom over a long period
right.
of time.
And
I know when we were going through, on our farm, we were going through a project with the NRCS, the National Resource Conservation Service. I always forget what that acronym stands for. But they are actually helping us do a pollinator habitat planting on our farm, which mm-hmm. is kind of a lot of what Julie's talking about. And we had a list of native plants that we had to work from. And what we were required to do was pick plants that, you know, were very early or late winter bloomers, mm-hmm. you know, early spring, late spring, midsummer, late summer, early fall. Because they, you know, the idea is to have food sources there for bees all throughout the year. I know willow is actually a really important
yeah,
pollinator plant because it blooms mm-hmm. so early in
exactly.
the season.
Exactly. And that's something people don't necessarily think about as a flowering plant or the
uh-huh.
trees.
Yeah.
And one of the earliest that I've seen in bloom are the figworts. The hazelnut?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. So the hazelnuts and then the willows and alders are three of our early bloomers that are really important to the bees.
Yeah.
And then pretty much things that what you're saying is exactly true. And I was going to mention that is that if you were going to plant for pollinators, I would say go for the early bloomers and go for the late bloomers, because the bees are not going to have any trouble finding stuff this time of year, because everything's in bloom right now. But for the bumblebees that are coming out in January, and I have seen them in January, if there's nothing in bloom in the area where they come out of hibernation, they're going to die because there isn't anything for them to eat. And so if you can provide that resource for them, you're doing a world of good for an animal that will do a world of good for you. And then same thing for the later bees. If you have something like goldenrod, which blooms late into the year, then that's going to be helpful for the animals that are coming out later in the season as well. Mm-hmm. So it's not a native plant, but one of my favorite plants that I discovered growing as a weed in our yard is evening primrose.
That's a beautiful plant.
Yeah,
though.
It is. But I let every evening primrose live. I don't mow them. I don't knock them down with the weed eater, because they bloom. They're starting to bloom now. And they bloom through November.
Yeah.
And so they're my latest bloomer in our yard. So I keep every one I find, just simply so there's that resource for the bees that come around and for the ones that are in my apiary.
Yeah.
So tell us a little about honeybees. I mean, how are they different from our native population of bees?
They're amazingly different. Honeybees are the only bee in our area that stores food. Well, let me rephrase that. They're the only ones that hoard food. Bumblebees will store food, but just a little. They might have 2 or 3 days' worth of food in their hive at most. Honeybees store enough food where they can overwinter, and they are the only bee that overwinters. All of our native bees will produce queens or create offspring that overwinters either as a hibernating adult or as a pupae in a cocoon. And then in the spring, then they will hatch or come out of hibernation and start the life cycle over as individuals, either building a hive like the bumblebees or laying more eggs like mason bees and leafcutters. Honeybees will go into the winter with a full colony. And that could be, 30,000 bees at that time of year. They do kick out the boys, because the boys, the drones, really only have one function.
So the boys are called the drones.
Yeah, and their function is to mate with queens that come out in the summer. In the wintertime, there's no need for them, and so they're dispatched and either just kicked out of the hive or killed because they won't stay out of the hive. And so the hive goes into the winter with thousands of workers, and because they're not foraging, they actually can survive several months in the summertime.
Just on the stored honey that they have.
Yep.
Yeah.
Just on the stored honey. And it's because of that stored honey that they're able to overwinter, and it's because of that stored honey that they're so successful, because when spring comes, they're starting, rather than just a queen who has to start from scratch, they're starting as an entire colony that can go out and forage and start producing thousands of young immediately.
So a question that I would have is then, so if as a beekeeper you're taking honey out of the hive, what do the bees live on through the winter?
Oh, that's a good point. The way that I keep my bees, I have I use a system called the Langstroth hive, which is a relatively a square box, and it comes in the box is typically about 9.5 inches deep. I use 2 of those boxes for my bees. And so they can fill up those boxes with honey and brood. And typically what I've seen in my apiary is that they'll fill up one box with brood, which is the young, and then they'll use the other box for storage. And then I have a third box that I put on top that's about 6.5 inches deep, and that's called a super. And the super, I don't know why it's called the super, maybe because it's super that I get all that honey at the end of the year. But the super, anything they put in the super is what I consider to be excess and honey that they don't need to survive. And that's what's so great about them, is that they are hoarders. They will bring in more honey than they need to survive a winter. And so that extra honey that's in the super is all that I will take from them. Everything that's in the brood boxes, those deeper boxes, I leave for them for the winter.
Well, Julie, this is just amazingly interesting. We're going to take a short station break. You are listening to Coast Community Radio, KMUN 91.9 FM, and streaming live at coastradio.org. And if you are just joining us, we're talking to Julie Tennis from Nassau, Washington, also known as the Bee Mentor.
So, Julie, you know, one thing that we were talking about earlier before the show was thinking about honey as a food. And I know you mentioned something about one of the reasons that you got interested in honey was because you had problems with sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I had always been told that honey and sugar are the same thing. And so maybe can you talk a little bit about why honey is different than sugar? And
I don't know the science behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm speaking from opinion and just guessing here. But
yeah.
From my understanding of working with plants, when you are dealing with raw honey, it's not just sugar. It's got all the enzymes from the... Well, let me back up a minute. Do you know how honey's made?
Yeah, so why don't you back
yes.
up a minute?
Yeah, so honey isn't a product of plants. Nectar comes from plants. Bees fly to different flowers, and they gather up nectar, which is... It's basically a byproduct of photosynthesis
mm-hmm.
of the plant. And it is mostly water, and it has some carbohydrates mixed in. So the bees, they gather this nectar, and they take it back to the hive. Now, the way that they carry the nectar is they store it in a kind of a special stomach in their bodies, and the honey stomach, and they take it back to the hive, and then they transfer it to another bee who ingests it and digests it partially. They have special enzymes in the bee's gut that helped it to transform this nectar into what we know as honey. And it goes through a series of digestion episodes, I guess, where the bee will spit it out into the honeycomb.
People are never going to eat honey.
I know. Whenever I think about this, I think of the movie Dune or the story Dune, you know, in Spice.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, and if you don't know what I'm talking about, you can Google it. So they spit it out, and then they ingest it again and digest it some more. And they do this several times. And when it's reached a point where they're happy with it, then they leave it in the cell in the honeycomb. And then they fan it with their wings. And the reason they fan it is they're dehydrating it. And so they're dropping that water content down to about 18%.
Wow.
And that's why honey's so thick.
Uh-huh.
You know, when they first put the honey in the cell, you can turn the cell over and it'll pour out because it's very liquid. So they need to dry it out, which helps keep it from fermenting as well. When it reaches about 18%, then they cap it off. They put a layer of wax over the top of the cell to seal it in.
And tell us about the wax. I mean, okay, so.
So for those of you who like eating beeswax, you might want to not listen to this part. But wax is actually a secretion from the bee, from special glands in its abdomen.
Uh-huh.
And it's pretty much the same thing as it's not the same thing, but you know how your ears produce wax?
Right, right.
Well, mm-hmm. bees produce wax from their bodies
right.
too. So it has nothing to do with plants. It's not a plant product. It comes out of the bee's body. And they excrete it, and it's kind of a clear little scales that come out from between the pieces of their abdomen. And then they chew on it, and then they stick it in place and make
to seal the
yeah to seal
that's
the honey.
That's so great, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
And so I just have to ask, how long does a honeybee live? I mean, what's their age?
It depends. The drones,
uh-huh.
drones. Well, actually, I don't know how long drones live. I imagine they probably live a little bit longer than worker bees. I don't know. I'd have to look that up. But worker bees, in the summertime, live about 6 weeks if they're lucky. And in the wintertime, they can actually live several months. And just from seeing what my bees look like after a week or two of foraging, I can imagine the reason they live so much longer in the winter is because they're not flying so
they're
much.
They're not doing as much.
They fly yeah.
they
long
do.
Distances.
They do. They say it takes about 2 million trips to a flower
wow.
to make a pound of honey.
Wow.
And those bees are grabbing those. So each flower only contains just a little drop, like a dewdrop's worth of nectar, if that. And the bees fill their stomachs, which only can hold a few dewdrops, and then they fly back to the hive, they drop it off, and they go out again. And, you know, sometimes...
I have so much respect for them now.
Yeah.
Wow, that's...
I think that if we were paying the actual cost of the effort required to make honey, we wouldn't be able to afford it. Because there's so much work involved.
So tell us a little about the queen. So we talked about the mm-hmm. drones, we talked about the worker bees, and mm-hmm. what about the queen?
The queen is the kind of the nucleus of the hive. She doesn't give orders. You know, when we think of queens, we think of a typical hierarchy in human culture. But in the hive, it's more of a group dynamic. So the queen is the only one who can lay female eggs. Mm-hmm. And the she can lay female eggs because she's been fertilized. Any worker bee, any female bee, can lay an unfertilized egg, which will hatch out into a drone, into a boy bee. But it takes a fertilized egg to turn into a worker bee. And if you don't have worker bees, then you don't have a colony. Yeah. Because the drones don't gather nectar or pollen. They just kind of hang out and get fed by the worker bees and then help procreate the species by mating with the queen. The queens, though, they will live for, if you're lucky, they can live about 3 to 5 years, depending on the individual. And so they're much more long-lived. They provide that continuity of the hive because the workers are cycling through, and then the queen is kind of that stable presence.
So the queen, I mean, out of the world of bees, you've got this colony of bees, which, I mean, do they all have about the same number or...?
That depends too. I've got some colonies that are really small. Uh-huh. That I caught as swarms last year, and I don't know the numbers, but two of the swarms I caught last year were the size of really large oranges or small grapefruits, which is not a lot of bees. Typically, when I catch a swarm, it's about the size of a basketball, maybe a little smaller. So there's a lot less bees in those smaller ones, and they still don't have very big numbers. And one of them, the queen, died. Oh. And the other one isn't laying very well. So I think both of them were near the end of their life cycle. And so they didn't recruit a lot of bees to leave with them when they swarmed. And they're also not producing a lot of bees because they don't have many eggs left. Mm-hmm. Swarming is how bee colonies reproduce. So if you look at the bee as the colony as an organism, and the queen can sort of be related to the brain and the worker bees to the muscles and the limbs. You know, they're doing the work and the queen kind of helps direct all that effort.
Yeah.
And then the reproductive organs of that organism are the queen and the drones. Well, the organism as a whole, in order to reproduce, it splits kind of like an amoeba. The queen will create, and she'll lay an egg in a special chamber that the worker bees have created. And it's a larger egg cell, or a larger honeycomb cell, basically, to accommodate the size of a queen larvae. And then the workers feed that egg, that larvae, after it hatches, royal jelly, its entire life as a larvae. And then they cap it off and it pupates and it will hatch into a new queen. When it's about a day or two from hatching, the original queen will leave and about half of the colony will go with her. And then the ones that remain behind will support the new queen when she hatches.
And so, I have so much appreciation for honey now. I just feel like I want to go home and eat some and just savor it. Thinking about honey, I mean, eating it too. I mean, this is a wonderful product that a lot of people really enjoy. And what are some things that you like to do with honey? I mean, for you, thinking about, like, how do you use it in your cooking? Or
well, the reason that I started, that I became a beekeeper was because my dad's a beekeeper, and he was my honey source, basically, for years. And when my husband and I moved into our own home and had our own property, my dad showed up one day with a beehive.
Oh, what a nice housewarming gift.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. And basically he's like, okay, here you go. It's time for you to start making your own. And so that's how I got started with my bees. And basically, any recipe that requires sugar, because of my allergy to sugar, I had to use something else. And so I used honey. Mm-hmm. And so I use it in baking, and I use it in cooking regular dishes like spaghetti sauce. If you look at the label on pretty much anything you buy in the store, it has sugar in it. And so I had to find a replacement for that. And so making spaghetti sauce, for example, I just use tomato paste and tomatoes, you know, the raw product. And then I use honey as a sweetener to make it so it doesn't just taste like tomato sauce. Mm-hmm. And along with the other stuff. In baking, I use it as a straight replacement for sugar. Well, I alter the amount a bit depending on the recipe.
Julie, you mentioned royal jelly too, and I know it's not jelly the way we think of it. So can you explain royal jelly?
Yeah, I don't know a lot about royal jelly. I know that it's another secretion from the bees that the worker bees create, and I believe there's a gland in their head that it comes from. And it's something that gets fed to every larvae for the first 3 days of its life. And that just helps to, it's really a concentrated food source. It'd be like eating an energy bar, I guess, would be an analogy for it. And a really good energy bar.
Yeah.
Not one of those sugar-packed ones. But they feed the royal jelly to them for 3 days, and then they'll switch them over just to like a pollen nectar diet. And then, like I said, with the queen bees, they'll keep her on the royal jelly for her entire larval stage before she pupates. And that just helps her body develop completely. Basically, it helps her, mm-hmm. her ovaries to develop and makes a sexually mature bee as opposed to just a worker bee.
Mm-hmm. So okay, and then how often in a year for a hive would you collect honey from them?
I just do it once a year.
So just once a year.
Mm-hmm. The bees start gathering in the spring, and it takes a while for them to fill up the frames of the hive. So the box that I was describing to you earlier has 10 frames in it, and each frame is filled with honeycomb on both sides. So if you imagine file folders in a mm-hmm. in a filing cabinet, so each frame is like a file folder. And not like I mentioned earlier, they have to ingest and regurgitate mm-hmm. this stuff over and over again, and then they have to fan it down to 18%, and that takes a lot of work and a long period of time. And so I don't pull the honey until it's capped, because then I know it's fully processed, and mm-hmm. it isn't all capped until late August or September, at least in the hives that I've worked with.
And can you taste the difference in honeys?
Like, yeah.
Depending on what flowers they've been working. I've tasted different honeys from mm-hmm. different areas, depending on what the bees have been feeding on. And it's amazing how much difference there is.
Yeah, there's some producers who are able to specifically target a particular type of plant. So they'll take their bees to an area that's all clover, for example. And so they mm-hmm. can say they have clover honey. And you can tell the difference between like clover honey and buckwheat honey or, almond honey. There's definitely a difference in the taste. And I sold honey at the River People's Farmers Market last year, and I had two distinct varieties.
One was really light, and mm-hmm. one that was kind of really deep amber.
Yeah, and so the light colored one was very fragrant. It smelled a bit like cotton candy. And then the one that was darker smelled almost like rose to me. And I don't know where my bees just forage. It's called mm-hmm. wildflower honey because I really don't know where they're getting it. Although I do believe that the light colored honey was coming from holly flowers.
Well, we've managed to go through another 30 minutes. Oh. This has been fascinating. And I want you to be able, can you tell people how they could get a hold of you, learn about your programs.
Learn more about beekeeping.
Yeah, yeah mm-hmm. I have a website called beementor.com, so www.beementor.com. And as the site develops, my intention for it is to be a place where people can come to learn more about bees and beekeeping. So I'm not the expert on the site. I bring people in that can help share that information. So I'm planning to do regular interviews of people, and there are a couple up already. And then also bringing in information that I find from other places, as well as telling the story of what's happening in my own apiary.
Thank you so much for
joining us today on Food Talk.
Well, thank you.
Fresh conversations about local food on the North Coast. This show will be available as a podcast at coastradio.org.
Food Talk is a production of North Coast Food Web, bringing local food to everyone on Oregon's North Coast. And we also like to thank Mark Albrecht, our sound engineer, and thanks to Luke and Katie for our theme song.
Comes from